There were 10 of the little low-powered rocket scooters under my proud command, as well as 4 of the larger interstation shuttles used to ferry stores and personnel from orbit to orbit. I couldn't hope to borrow one of those, but after several weeks of careful organizing, I was able to carry out the plan I'd conceived some 2 microseconds after being told I was now head of transport. There's no need to tell how I juggled duty lists, cooked logs and fuel registers, and persuaded my colleagues to cover up for me. All that matters is that about once a week I would climb into my personal spacesuit, strap myself to the spidery framework of a Mark III scooter, and drift away from the station at minimum power. When I was well clear, I'd go over to full throttle, and the tiny rocket motor would hustle me across the 900-mile gap to the observatory. The trip took about 30 minutes, and the navigational requirements were elementary. I could see where I was going and where I'd come from, yet I don't mind admitting that I often felt, well, a trifle lonely around the midpoint of the journey. There was no other solid matter within almost 500 miles, and it looked an awfully long way down to Earth. It was a great help at such moments to tune the suit radio to the general service band and to listen to all the back chat between ships and stations. At mid-flight, I'd have to spin the scooter around and start braking, and 10 minutes later, the observatory would be close enough for its details to be visible to the unaided eye. Very shortly after that, I'd drift up to a small plastic pressure bubble that was in the process of being fitted out as a spectroscopic laboratory, and there would be Julie, waiting on the other side of the airlock. I won't pretend that we confined our discussions to the latest results in astrophysics or the progress of the satellite construction schedule. Few things indeed were further from our thoughts, and the journey home always seemed to flash by at a quite astonishing speed. It was around mid-orbit on one of those homeward trips that the radar started to flash on my little control panel. There was something large at extreme range, and it was coming in fast. A meteor, I told myself, maybe even a small asteroid. Anything giving such a signal should be visible to the eye. I read off the bearings and searched the star fields in the indicated direction. The thought of a collision never even crossed my mind. Space is so inconceivably vast that I was thousands of times safer than a man crossing a busy street on Earth. There it was, a bright and steadily growing star near the foot of Orion. It already outshone Rigel, and seconds later it was not merely a star but had begun to show a visible disk. Now it was moving as fast as I could turn my head. It grew to a tiny misshaped moon, then dwindled and shrank with that same silent, inexorable speed. I suppose I had a clear view of it for perhaps half a second, and that half second has haunted me all my life. The object had already vanished by the time I thought of checking the radar again, so I had no way of gauging how close it had come, and hence how large it really was. It could have been a small object 100 feet away or a very large one 10 miles off. There is no sense of perspective in space, and unless you know what you are looking at, you cannot judge its distance. Of course, it could have been a very large and oddly shaped meteor. I can never be sure that my eyes, straining to grasp the details of so swiftly moving an object, were not hopelessly deceived. I may have imagined that I saw that broken, crumpled prow and the cluster of dark ports like sightless sockets of a skull. Of one thing only was I certain, even in that brief and fragmentary vision. If it was a ship, it was not one of ours. Its shape was utterly alien, and it was very, very old. It may be that the greatest discovery of all time slipped from my grasp as I struggled with my thoughts midway between the 2 space stations. But I had no measurements of speed or direction. Whatever it was that I had glimpsed was now lost beyond recapture in the wastes of the solar system. What should I have done? No one would ever have believed me, for I would have had no proof. Had I made a report, there would have been endless trouble. I should have become the laughingstock of the space service, would have been reprimanded for misuse of equipment, and would certainly not have been able to see Julie again. And to me, at that age, nothing else was as important. If you've been in love yourself, you'll understand. If not, then no explanation is any use. So I said nothing. To some other man, how many centuries hence, will go the fame for proving that we were not the firstborn of the children of the sun. Whatever it may be that is circling out there on its eternal orbit can wait, as it has waited ages already. Yet I sometimes wonder, would I have made a report after all had I known that Julie was going to marry someone else? The call of the stars. Down there on Earth, the 20th century is dying. As I look across at the shadowed globe blocking the stars, I can see the lights of 100 sleepless cities, and there are moments when I wish that I could be among the crowds now surging and singing in the streets of London, Cape Town, Rome, Paris, Berlin, Madrid. Yes, I can see them all at a single glance, burning like fireflies against the darkened planet. The line of midnight is now bisecting Europe. In the eastern Mediterranean, the tiny, brilliant stars pulsing as some exuberant pleasure ship waves her searchlights to the sky. I think she is deliberately aiming at us. For the past few minutes, the flashes have been quite regular and startlingly bright. Presently, I'll call the communication center and find out who she is so that I can radio back our own greetings. Passing into history now, receding forever down the stream of time, is the most incredible 100 years the world has ever seen. It opened with the conquest of the air, saw at its midpoint the unlocking of the atom, and now ends with the bridging of space. For the past 5 minutes, I've been wondering what's happening to Nairobi. Now I realize that they are putting on a mammoth fireworks display. Chemically fueled rockets may be obsolete out here, but they're still using lots of them down on Earth tonight. The end of a century, and the end of a millennium. What will the 100 years that begin with 2 and 0 bring? The planets, of course. Floating there in space, only a mile away, are the ships of the first Martian expedition. For 2 years, I've watched them grow, assembled piece by piece, as the space station itself was built by the men I worked with a generation ago. Those 10 ships are ready now, with all their crews aboard, waiting for the final instrument check and the signal for departure. Before the first day of the new century has passed its noon, they will be tearing free from the reins of Earth to head out toward the strange world that may one day be man's second home.